Just as Newton had been born the year that Galileo died, so Einstein was born the year that Maxwell died, and he saw it as part of his mission to extend the work of the Scotsman. Here was a theorist who had shed prevailing biases, let mathematical melodies lead him into unknown territories, and found a harmony that was based on the beauty and simplicity of a field theory. At first, the electromagnetic field theory developed by Maxwell seemed compatible with the mechanics of Newton. For example, Maxwell believed that electromagnetic waves, which include visible light, could be explained by classical mechanics, if we assume that the universe is suffused with some unseen, gossamer, light-bearing ether that serves as the physical substance that undulates and oscillates to propagate the electromagnetic waves, comparable to the role water plays for ocean waves and air plays for sound waves. By the end of the 19th century, however, fissures had begun to develop in the foundations of classical physics. One problem was that scientists, as hard as they tried, could not find any evidence of our motion through this supposed light-propagating ether. The study of radiation, how light and other electromagnetic waves emanate from physical bodies, exposed another problem. Strange things were happening at the borderline where Newtonian theories, which described the mechanics of discrete particles, interacted with field theory, which described all electromagnetic phenomena. Up until then, Einstein had published 5 little-noted papers. They had earned him neither a doctorate nor a teaching job, even at a high school. There was no sign that he was about to unleash an annus mirabilis the like of which science had not seen since 1666, when Isaac Newton, holed up at his mother's home in rural Woolsthorpe to escape the plague that was devastating Cambridge, developed calculus, an analysis of the light spectrum, and the laws of gravity. But physics was poised to be upended again, and Einstein was poised to be the one to do it. The breakthroughs that he wrought during a 4-month frenzy from March to June 1905 were heralded in what would become one of the most famous personal letters in the history of science. Conrad Habicht, his fellow philosophical frolicker in the Olympia Academy, had just moved away from Bern, which, happily for historians, gave a reason for Einstein to write to him in late May. Dear Habicht, such a solemn air of silence has descended between us that I almost feel as if I am committing a sacrilege when I break it now with some inconsequential babble. So what are you up to, you frozen whale, you smoked, dried, canned piece of soul? Why have you still not sent me your dissertation? Don't you know that I am one of the 1.5 fellows who would read it with interest and pleasure, you wretched man? I promise you 4 papers in return. The first deals with radiation and the energy properties of light, and is very revolutionary, as you will see, if you send me your work first. The second paper is a determination of the true sizes of atoms. The third proves that bodies on the order of magnitude of 1/1000th millimeter, suspended in liquids, must already perform an observable random motion that is produced by thermal motion. Such movement of suspended bodies has actually been observed by physiologists who call it Brownian molecular motion. The fourth paper is only a rough draft at this point, and is an electrodynamics of moving bodies which employs a modification of the theory of space and time. Light quanta, March 1905. As Einstein noted to Habicht, it was the first of these 1905 papers, not the famous final one expounding a theory of relativity, that deserved the designation revolutionary. Indeed, it may contain the most revolutionary development in the history of physics. Its suggestion that light comes not just in waves but in tiny packets, quanta of light that were later dubbed photons, spirits us into strange scientific mists that are far murkier, indeed more spooky, than even the weirdest aspects of the theory of relativity. Einstein recognized this in the slightly odd title he gave to the paper, which he submitted on March 17, 1905, to the Annalen der Physik. On a heuristic point of view concerning the production and transformation of light. Heuristic? It means a hypothesis that serves as a guide and gives direction in solving a problem, but is not considered proven. From this first sentence he ever published about quantum theory until his last such sentence, which came in a paper exactly 50 years later, just before he died, Einstein regarded the concept of the quanta and all of its unsettling implications as heuristic at best, provisional and incomplete and not fully compatible with his own intimations of underlying reality. At the heart of Einstein's paper were questions that were bedeviling physics at the turn of the century, and in fact have done so from the time of the ancient Greeks until today. Is the universe made up of particles, such as atoms and electrons? Or is it an unbroken continuum, as a gravitational or electromagnetic field seems to be? And if both methods of describing things are valid at times, what happens when they intersect? Since the 1860s, scientists had been exploring just such a point of intersection by analyzing what was called black body radiation. As anyone who has played with a kiln or a gas burner knows, the glow from a material such as iron changes color as it heats up. First, it appears to radiate mainly red light. As it gets hotter, it glows more orange, and then white, and then blue. To study this radiation, Gustav Kirchhoff and others devised a closed metal container with a tiny hole to let a little light escape. Then they drew a graph of the intensity of each wavelength when the device reached equilibrium at a certain temperature. No matter what the material or shape of the container's walls, the results were the same. The shape of the graphs depended only on the temperature. There was, alas, a problem. No one could fully account for the basis of the mathematical formula that would produce the hill-like shape of these graphs. When Kirchhoff died, his professorship at the University of Berlin was given to Max Planck. Born in 1858 into an ancient German family of great scholars, theologians, and lawyers, Planck was many things that Einstein was not. With his pince-nez glasses and meticulous dress, he was very proudly German, somewhat shy, steely in his resolve, conservative by instinct, and formal in his manner. His conservatism made Planck skeptical about the atom and of particle rather than wave and continuous field theories in general. In one of our planet's little ironies, Planck and Einstein would share the fate of laying the groundwork for quantum mechanics, and then both would flinch when it became clear that it undermined the concepts of strict causality and certainty they both worshipped. In 1900, Planck came up with an equation, partly using what he called a fortuitous guess, that described the curve of radiation wavelengths at each temperature. In so doing, he accepted that Boltzmann's statistical methods, which he had resisted, were correct after all. But the equation had an odd feature. It required the use of a constant, which was an unexplained tiny quantity that needed to be included for it to come out right. It was soon dubbed Planck's constant, H, and is now known as one of the fundamental constants of nature. At first, Planck had no idea what, if any, physical meaning this mathematical constant had. But then he came up with a theory that, he thought, applied not to the nature of light itself, but to the action that occurred when the light was absorbed or emitted by a piece of matter. He posited that the surface of anything that was radiating heat and light, such as the walls in a blackbody device, contained vibrating molecules or harmonic oscillators like little vibrating springs. These harmonic oscillators could absorb or emit energy only in the form of discrete packets or bundles. These packets or bundles of energy came only in fixed amounts, determined by Planck's constant, rather than being divisible or having a continuous range of values. Planck considered his constant a mere calculational contrivance that explained the process of emitting or absorbing light, but did not apply to the fundamental nature of light itself. Nevertheless, the declaration he made to the Berlin Physical Society in December 1900 was momentous. We therefore regard, and this is the most essential point of the entire calculation, energy to be composed of a very definite number of equal, finite packages. Einstein quickly realized that quantum theory could undermine classical physics. All of this was quite clear to me shortly after the appearance of Planck's fundamental work, he wrote later. All of my attempts to adapt the theoretical foundation of physics to this knowledge failed completely. It was as if the ground had been pulled out from under us, with no firm foundation to be seen anywhere. In addition to the problem of explaining what Planck's constant was really all about, there was another curiosity about radiation that needed to be explained. It was called the photoelectric effect, and it occurs when light shining on a metal surface causes electrons to be knocked loose and emitted. In the letter he wrote to Marich right after he learned of her pregnancy in May 1901, Einstein enthused over a beautiful piece by Philip Lenard that explored this topic. Lenard would be one of Einstein's early inspirations, but later one of his most hateful anti-Semitic tormentors. Lenard's experiment found something unexpected. When he increased the frequency of the light, moving from infrared heat and red light up in frequency to violet and ultraviolet, the emitted electrons sped out with much more energy. Then he increased the intensity of the light by using a carbon arc light that could be made brighter by a factor of 1,000. The brighter, more intense light had a lot more energy, so it seemed logical that the electrons emitted would have more energy and speed away faster. But that did not occur. More intense light produced more electrons, but the energy of each remained the same. This was something that the wave theory of light did not explain. Einstein had been pondering the work of Planck and Lenard for 4 years. In his final paper of 1904 on the general molecular theory of heat, he discussed how the average energy of a system of molecules fluctuates. He then applied this to a volume filled with radiation and found that experimental results were comparable. He was thus primed, so it seems, to form a theory that the radiation field was made up of quanta. In his 1905 light quanta paper, published a year later, he did just that. He took the mathematical quirk that Planck had discovered, interpreted it literally, related it to Lenard's photoelectric results, and analyzed light as if it really was made up of point-like particles, light quanta, he called them, rather than being a continuous wave. Einstein began his paper by describing the great distinction between theories based on particles and theories that involve continuous functions. There exists a profound formal difference between the theories that physicists have formed about gases and other ponderable bodies and Maxwell's theory of electromagnetic processes in so-called empty space, he noted. While we consider the state of a body to be completely determined by the positions and velocities of a very large, yet finite, number of atoms and electrons, we make use of continuous spatial functions to describe the electromagnetic state of a given volume. Before he made his case for a particle theory of light, he emphasized that this would not make it necessary to scrap the wave theory, which would continue to be useful as well. The wave theory of light, which operates with continuous spatial functions, has worked well in the representation of purely optical phenomena and will probably never be replaced by another theory. His way of accommodating both a wave theory and a particle theory was to suggest in a heuristic way that our observation of waves involves statistical averages of the positions of what could be countless particles. It should be kept in mind, he said, that the optical observations refer to time averages rather than instantaneous values. Then came what may be the most revolutionary sentence that Einstein ever wrote. It suggests that light is made up of discrete particles or packets of energy. According to the assumption to be considered here, when a light ray is propagated from a point, the energy is not continuously distributed over an increasing space, but consists of a finite number of energy quanta, which are localized at points in space, and which can be produced and absorbed only as complete units. Einstein explored this hypothesis by determining whether a volume of blackbody radiation, which he was now assuming consisted of discrete quanta, might in fact behave like a volume of gas, which he knew consisted of discrete particles. First, he looked at the formulas that showed how the entropy of a gas changes when its volume changes. Then he compared this to how the entropy of blackbody radiation changes as its volume changes. He found that the entropy of the radiation varies with volume according to the same law as the entropy of an ideal gas. This led Einstein to declare that the radiation behaves thermodynamically as if it consisted of mutually independent energy quanta. It also provided a way to calculate the energy of a particle of light at a particular frequency, which turned out to be in accord with what Planck had found. Einstein went on to show how the existence of these light quanta could explain what he graciously called Lenard's pioneering work on the photoelectric effect. If light came in discrete quanta, then the energy of each one was determined simply by the frequency of the light multiplied by Planck's constant. If we assume, Einstein suggested, that a light quantum transfers its entire energy to a single electron, then it follows that light of a higher frequency would cause the electrons to emit with more energy. On the other hand, increasing the intensity of the light, but not the frequency, would simply mean that more electrons would be emitted, but the energy of each would be the same. That was precisely what Lennart had found. By blowing on Planck's embers, Einstein had turned them into a flame that would consume classical physics. What precisely did Einstein produce that made his 1905 paper a discontinuous, one is tempted to say quantum, leap beyond the work of Planck? Einstein considered the light quantum to be a feature of reality, a perplexing, pesky, mysterious, and sometimes maddening quirk in the cosmos. For him, these quanta of energy, which in 1926 were named photons, existed even when light was moving through a vacuum. Einstein's theory produced a law of the photoelectric effect that was experimentally testable. The energy of emitted electrons would depend on the frequency of the light according to a simple mathematical formula involving Planck's constant. The formula was subsequently shown to be correct. Einstein would increasingly find the eerie implications of the quantum and of the wave-particle duality of light to be deeply unsettling. In a letter he wrote near the end of his life to his dear friend Michele Besso, after quantum mechanics had been accepted by almost every living physicist, Einstein would lament, "All these 50 years of pondering have not brought me any closer to answering the question, what are light quanta?" Doctoral dissertation on the size of molecules, April 1905. Einstein had written a paper that would revolutionize science, but he had not yet been able to earn a doctorate. He realized that he needed a safe topic, not a radical one like quanta or relativity, so he chose the second paper he was working on, titled A New Determination of Molecular Dimensions, which he completed on April 30th and submitted to the University of Zurich in July. Perhaps out of caution and deference to the conservative approach of his advisor, Alfred Kleiner, he generally avoided the innovative statistical physics featured in his previous papers and in his Brownian motion paper completed 11 days later, and relied instead mainly on classical hydrodynamics. Yet he was still able to explore how the behavior of countless tiny particles, atoms, molecules, are reflected in observable phenomena, and conversely, how observable phenomena can tell us about the nature of those tiny unseen particles. Almost a century earlier, the Italian scientist Amedeo Avogadro, 1776 to 1856, had developed the hypothesis, correct as it turned out, that equal volumes of any gas, when measured at the same temperature and pressure, will have the same number of molecules. That led to a difficult quest, figuring out just how many this was. The volume usually chosen is that occupied by a mole of the gas, its molecular weight in grams, which is 22.4 liters at standard temperature and pressure. The number of molecules under such conditions later became known as Avogadro's number. Determining it precisely was, and still is, rather difficult. A current estimate is approximately 6.02214 times 10 to the 23rd. This is a big number. That many unpopped popcorn kernels, when spread across the United States, would cover the country 9 miles deep. Most previous measurements of molecules had been done by studying gases. But as Einstein noted in the first sentence of his paper, the physical phenomena observed in liquids have thus far not served for the determination of molecular sizes. In this dissertation, after a few math and data corrections were later made, Einstein was the first person able to get a respectable result using liquids. His method involved making use of data about viscosity, which is how much resistance a liquid offers to an object that tries to move through it. Tar and molasses, for example, are highly viscous. If you dissolve sugar in water, the solution's viscosity increases as it gets more syrupy. Einstein envisioned the sugar molecules gradually diffusing their way through the smaller water molecules. He was able to come up with two equations, each containing the two unknown variables, the size of the sugar molecules and the number of them in the water, that he was trying to determine. Einstein later said, perhaps half-jokingly, that when he submitted his thesis, Professor Kleiner rejected it for being too short. So he added one more sentence, and it was promptly accepted. There is no documentary evidence for this. Either way, his thesis actually became one of his most cited and practically useful papers, with applications in such diverse fields as cement mixing, dairy production, and aerosol products. And even though it did not help him get an academic job, it did make it possible for him to become known, finally, as Dr. Einstein. Brownian Motion, May 1905. 11 days after finishing his dissertation, Einstein produced another paper exploring evidence of things unseen. As he had been doing since 1901, he relied on statistical analysis of the random actions of invisible particles to show how they were reflected in the visible world. In doing so, Einstein explained a phenomenon known as Brownian motion that had been puzzling scientists for almost 80 years. Why small particles suspended in a liquid, such as water, are observed to jiggle around. And as a byproduct, he pretty much settled once and for all that atoms and molecules actually existed as physical objects. Brownian motion was named after the Scottish botanist Robert Brown, who in 1828 had published detailed observations about how minuscule pollen particles suspended in water can be seen to wiggle and wander when examined under a strong microscope. The study was replicated with other particles, including filings from the Sphinx, and a variety of explanations was offered. Perhaps it had something to do with tiny water currents or the effect of light, but none of these theories proved plausible. With the rise in the 1870s of the kinetic theory, which used the random motions of molecules to explain things like the behavior of gases, some tried to use it to explain Brownian motion. But because the suspended particles were 10,000 times larger than a water molecule, it seemed that a molecule would not have the power to budge the particle, any more than a baseball could budge an object that was a half mile in diameter. Einstein showed that even though one collision could not budge a particle, the effect of millions of random collisions per second could explain the jig observed by Brown. In this paper, he announced in his first sentence, it will be shown that, according to the molecular kinetic theory of heat, bodies of a microscopically visible size suspended in liquids must, as a result of thermal molecular motions, perform motions of such magnitudes that they can be easily observed with a microscope. Einstein realized that a bump from a single water molecule would not cause a suspended pollen particle to move enough to be visible. However, at any given moment, the particle was being hit from all sides by thousands of molecules. There would be some moments when a lot more bumps happened to hit one particular side of the particle. Then, in another moment, a different side might get the heaviest barrage. The result would be random little lurches that would result in what is known as a random walk. The best way for us to envision this is to imagine a drunk who starts at a lamppost and lurches one step in a random direction every second. After two such lurches, he may have gone back and forth to return to the lamp, or he may be two steps away in the same direction, or he may be one step west and one step northeast. A little mathematical plotting and charting reveals an interesting thing about such a random walk. Statistically, the drunk's distance from the lamp will be proportional to the square root of the number of seconds that have elapsed. Einstein wanted concrete predictions that could be tested, so he used both his theoretical knowledge and experimental data about viscosity and diffusion rates to come up with precise predictions showing the distance a particle should move depending on its size and the temperature of the liquid. For example, he predicted in the case of a particle with a diameter of 1/1000th of a millimeter in water at 17 degrees centigrade, the mean displacement in 1 minute would be about 6 microns. Here was something that could actually be tested, and with great consequence. If the motion discussed here can be observed, he wrote, then classical thermodynamics can no longer be viewed as strictly valid. Better at theorizing than at conducting experiments, Einstein ended his paper with a charming exhortation. Let us hope that a researcher will soon succeed in solving the problem presented here, which is so important for the theory of heat. Within months, a German experimenter named Henry Seidentopf, using a powerful microscope, confirmed Einstein's predictions. For all practical purposes, the physical reality of atoms and molecules was now conclusively proven. At the time, atoms and molecules were still far from being regarded as real, the theoretical physicist Max Born later recalled. I think that these investigations of Einstein have done more than any other work to convince physicists of the reality of atoms and molecules. A strength of Einstein's mind was that it could juggle a variety of ideas simultaneously. Even as he was pondering dancing particles in a liquid, he had been wrestling with a different theory that involved moving bodies and the speed of light. A day or so after sending in his Brownian motion paper, he was talking to his friend Michele Besso when a new brainstorm struck. It would produce, as he wrote Habicht in his famous letter of that month, a modification of the theory of space and time. Special Relativity, 1905. The Background. Relativity is a simple concept. It asserts that the fundamental laws of physics are the same, whatever your state of motion. For the special case of observers moving at a constant velocity, this concept is pretty easy to accept. Imagine a man in an armchair at home and a woman in an airplane gliding very smoothly above. Each can pour a cup of coffee, bounce a ball, shine a flashlight, or heat a muffin in a microwave, and have the same laws of physics apply. In fact, there is no way to determine which of them is in motion and which is at rest. The man in the armchair could consider himself at rest and the plane in motion, and the woman in the plane could consider herself at rest and the earth as gliding past. There is no experiment that can prove who is right. Indeed, there is no absolute right. All that can be said is that each is moving relative to the other. The special theory of relativity that Einstein developed in 1905 applies only to this special case, hence the name, a situation in which the observers are moving at a constant velocity relative to one another, uniformly in a straight line at a steady speed, referred to as an inertial reference system. The story of relativity best begins in 1632, when Galileo articulated the principle that the laws of motion and mechanics, the laws of electromagnetism had not yet been discovered, were the same in all constant velocity reference frames. In his Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, Galileo wanted to defend Copernicus's idea that the Earth does not rest motionless at the center of the universe, with everything else revolving around it. Skeptics contended that if the Earth was moving, as Copernicus said, we'd feel it. Galileo refuted this with a brilliantly clear thought experiment about being inside the cabin of a smoothly sailing ship. Shut yourself up with some friend in the main cabin below decks on some large ship, and have with you there some flies, butterflies, and other small flying animals. Have a large bowl of water with some fish in it. Hang up a bottle that empties drop by drop into a wide vessel beneath it. With the ship standing still, observe how carefully the little animals fly with equal speed to all sides of the cabin. The fish swim indifferently in all directions. The drops fall into the vessel beneath. And in throwing something to your friend, you need to throw it no more strongly in one direction than another, the distances being equal. Jumping with your feet together, you pass equal spaces in every direction. When you have observed all these things carefully, have the ship proceed with any speed you like, so long as the motion is uniform and not fluctuating this way and that. You will discover not the least change in all the effects named, nor could you tell from any of them whether the ship was moving or standing still. There is no better description of relativity, or at least of how that principle applies to systems that are moving at a constant velocity relative to each other. Sound waves and water waves are easily explained by classical mechanics. They are simply a traveling disturbance in some medium. That is why sound cannot travel through a vacuum. But it can travel through such things as air or water or metal. For example, sound waves move through room temperature air as a vibrating disturbance that compresses and rarefies the air at about 770 miles per hour. Deep inside Galileo's ship, sound and water waves behave as they do on land, because the air in the chamber and the water in the bowls are moving at the same velocity as the passengers. But now imagine that you go up on deck and look at the waves out in the ocean, or that you measure the speed of the sound waves from the horn of another boat. The speed at which these waves come toward you depends on your motion relative to the medium, the water or air, propagating them. In other words, the speed at which an ocean wave reaches you will depend on how fast you are moving through the water toward or away from the source of the wave. The speed of a sound wave relative to you will likewise depend on your motion relative to the air that's propagating the sound wave. Those relative speeds add up. Imagine that you are standing in the ocean as the waves come toward you at 10 miles per hour. If you jump on a jet ski and head directly into the waves at 40 miles per hour, you will see them moving toward you and zipping past you at a speed, relative to you, of 50 miles per hour. Likewise, imagine that sound waves are coming at you from a distant boat horn, rippling through the still air at 770 miles per hour toward the shore. If you jump on your jet ski and head toward the horn at 40 miles per hour, the sound waves will be moving toward you and zipping past you at a speed, relative to you, of 810 miles per hour. All of this led to a question that Einstein had been pondering since age 16, when he imagined riding alongside a light beam. Does light behave the same way? Newton had conceived of light as primarily a stream of emitted particles. But by Einstein's day, most scientists accepted the rival theory, propounded by Newton's contemporary, Christian Huygens, that light should be considered a wave. A wide variety of experiments had confirmed the wave theory by the late 19th century. For example, Thomas Young did a famous experiment, now replicated by high school students, showing how light passing through two slits produces an interference pattern that resembles that of water waves going through two slits. In each case, the crests and troughs of the waves emanating from each slit reinforce each other in some places and cancel each other out in some places. Robert Clerk Maxwell helped to enshrine this wave theory when he successfully conjectured a connection between light, electricity, and magnetism. He came up with equations that described the behavior of electric and magnetic fields, and when they were combined, they predicted electromagnetic waves. Maxwell found that these electromagnetic waves had to travel at a certain speed, approximately 186,000 miles per second. That was the speed that scientists had already measured for light, and it was obviously not a mere coincidence. It became clear that light was the visible manifestation of a whole spectrum of electromagnetic waves. This includes what we now call AM radio signals, with a wavelength of 300 yards, FM radio signals, 3 yards, and microwaves, 3 inches. As the wavelengths get shorter and the frequency of the wave cycles thus increases, they produce the spectrum of visible light, ranging from red, 25 millionths of an inch, to violet, 14 millionths of an inch. Even shorter wavelengths produce ultraviolet rays, X-rays, and gamma rays. When we speak of light and the speed of light, we mean all electromagnetic waves, not just the ones that are visible to our eyes. That raised some big questions. What was the medium that was propagating these waves? And their speed of 186,000 miles per second was a speed relative to what? The answer, it seemed, was that light waves are a disturbance of an unseen medium, which was called the ether, and that their speed is relative to this ether. In other words, the ether was for light waves something akin to what air was for sound waves. It appeared beyond question that light must be interpreted as a vibratory process in an elastic, inert medium filling up universal space, Einstein later noted. This ether, unfortunately, needed to have many puzzling properties. Because light from distant stars is able to reach the Earth, the ether had to pervade the entire known universe. It had to be so gossamer and, shall we say, so ethereal that it had no effect on planets and feathers floating through it. Yet it had to be stiff enough to allow a wave to vibrate through it at an enormous speed. All of this led to the great ether hunt of the late 19th century. If light was indeed a wave rippling through the ether, then you should see the waves going by you at a faster speed if you were moving through the ether toward the light source. Scientists devised all sorts of ingenious devices and experiments to detect such differences. They used a variety of suppositions of how the ether might behave. They looked for it as if it were motionless and the Earth passed freely through it. They looked for it as if the Earth dragged parts of it along in a blob, the way it does its own atmosphere. They even considered the unlikely possibility that the Earth was the only thing at rest with respect to the ether, and that everything else in the cosmos was spinning around, including the other planets, the sun, the stars, and presumably poor Copernicus in his grave. One experiment, which Einstein later called of fundamental importance in the special theory of relativity, was by the French physicist Hippolyte Fizeau, who sought to measure the speed of light in a moving medium. He split a light beam with a half-silvered angled mirror that sent one part of the beam through water in the direction of the water's flow, and the other part against the flow. The two parts of the beam were then reunited. If one route took longer, then the crests and troughs of its waves would be out of sync with the waves of the other beam. The experimenters could tell if this happened by looking at the interference pattern that resulted when the waves were rejoined. A different and far more famous experiment was done in Cleveland in 1887 by Albert Michelson and Edward Morley. They built a contraption that similarly split a light beam and sent one part back and forth to a mirror at the end of an arm facing in the direction of the Earth's movement, and the other part back and forth along an arm at a 90-degree angle to it. Once again, the two parts of the beam were then rejoined and the interference pattern analyzed to see if the path that was going up against the supposed ether wind would take longer. No matter who looked, or how they looked, or what suppositions they made about the behavior of the ether, no one was able to detect the elusive substance. No matter which way anything was moving, the speed of light in a vacuum was observed to be exactly the same. So scientists, somewhat awkwardly, turned their attention to coming up with explanations about why the ether existed but was undetectable in any experiment. Most notably, in the early 1890s, Hendrik Lorentz, the cosmopolitan and congenial Dutch father figure of theoretical physics, and, independently, the Irish physicist George Fitzgerald, came up with a hypothesis that solid objects contracted slightly when they moved through the ether. The Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction would shorten everything, including the measuring arms used by Michelson and Morley, and it would do so by just the exact amount to make the effect of the ether on light undetectable. Einstein felt that the situation was very depressing. Scientists found themselves unable to explain electromagnetism using the Newtonian mechanical view of nature, he said, and this led to a fundamental dualism, which in the long run was insupportable. Einstein's Road to Relativity. A new idea comes suddenly and in a rather intuitive way, Einstein once said. But, he hastened to add, intuition is nothing but the outcome of earlier intellectual experience. Einstein's discovery of special relativity involved an intuition based on a decade of intellectual as well as personal experiences. The most important and obvious, I think, was his deep understanding and knowledge of theoretical physics. He was also helped by his ability to visualize thought experiments, which had been encouraged by his education in Aarau. Also, there was his grounding in philosophy. From Hume and Mach, he had developed a skepticism about things that could not be observed, and this skepticism was enhanced by his innate rebellious tendency to question authority. Also, part of the mix, and probably reinforcing his ability to both visualize physical situations and cut to the heart of concepts, was the technological backdrop of his life, helping his uncle Jakob to refine the moving coils and magnets in a generator, working in a patent office that was being flooded with applications for new methods of coordinating clocks, having a boss who encouraged him to apply his skepticism, living near the clock tower and train station and just above the telegraph office in Bern, just as Europe was using electrical signals to synchronize clocks within time zones, and having as a sounding board his engineer friend Michele Besso, who worked with him at the patent office examining electromechanical devices. The ranking of these influences is, of course, a subjective judgment. After all, even Einstein himself could not be sure how the process unfolded. "It is not easy to talk about how I arrived at the theory of relativity," he said. "There were so many hidden complexities to motivate my thought." One thing we can note with some confidence is Einstein's main starting point. He repeatedly said that his path toward the theory of relativity began with his thought experiment at age 16 about what it would be like to ride at the speed of light alongside a light beam. This produced a paradox, he said, and it troubled him for the next 10 years. "If I pursue a beam of light with a velocity, c, velocity of light in a vacuum, I should observe such a beam of light as an electromagnetic field at rest, though spatially oscillating. There seems to be no such thing, however, neither on the basis of experience nor according to Maxwell's equations. From the very beginning, it appeared to me intuitively clear that, judged from the standpoint of such an observer, everything would have to happen according to the same laws as for an observer who, relative to the Earth, was at rest. For how should the first observer know or be able to determine that he is in a state of fast, uniform motion? One sees in this paradox the germ of the special relativity theory is already contained." This thought experiment did not necessarily undermine the ether theory of light waves. An ether theorist could imagine a frozen light beam, but it violated Einstein's intuition that the laws of optics should obey the principle of relativity. In other words, Maxwell's equations, which specify the speed of light, should be the same for all observers in constant velocity motion. The emphasis that Einstein placed on this memory indicates that the idea of a frozen light beam, or frozen electromagnetic waves, seemed instinctively wrong to him. In addition, the thought experiment suggests that he sensed a conflict between Newton's laws of mechanics and the constancy of the speed of light in Maxwell's equations. All of this instilled in him a state of psychic tension that he found deeply unnerving. At the very beginning, when the special theory of relativity began to germinate in me, I was visited by all sorts of nervous conflicts, he later recalled. When young, I used to go away for weeks in a state of confusion. There was also a more specific asymmetry that began to bother him. When a magnet moves relative to a wire loop, an electric current is produced. As Einstein knew from his experience with his family's generators, the amount of this electric current is exactly the same whether the magnet is moving while the coil seems to be sitting still, or the coil is moving while the magnet seems to be sitting still. He also had studied an 1894 book by Auguste Forpel, Introduction to Maxwell's Theory of Electricity. It had a section specifically on the electrodynamics of moving conductors that questioned whether, when induction occurs, there should be any distinction between whether the magnet or the conducting coil is said to be in motion. But according to the Maxwell-Lorentz theory, Einstein recalled, the theoretical interpretation of the phenomenon is very different for the two cases. In the first case, Faraday's law of induction said that the motion of the magnet through the ether created an electric field. In the second case, Lorentz's force law said a current was created by the motion of the conducting coil through the magnetic field. The idea that these two cases should essentially be different was unbearable to me, Einstein said. Einstein had been wrestling for years with the concept of the ether, which theoretically determined the definition of at rest in these electrical induction theories. After contemplating ways to detect the ether, he read a paper by Wilhelm Wien that described the null results of 13 ether detection experiments, including those by Michelson and Morley and by Fizeau. He also learned about the Michelson-Morley experiment by reading, sometime before 1905, Lorentz's 1895 book, Attempt at a Theory of Electrical and Optical Phenomena in Moving Bodies. In this book, Lorentz goes through various failed attempts to detect the ether as a prelude to developing his theory of contractions. Induction and deduction in physics. So what effect did the Michelson-Morley results, which showed no evidence of the ether and no difference in the observed speed of light, no matter in what direction the observer was moving, have on Einstein as he was incubating his ideas on relativity? It's clear that he was aware of them. He simply took for granted, by the time he started working seriously on relativity, that there was no need to review all the ether drift experiments because, based on his starting assumptions, all attempts to detect the ether were doomed to failure. For him, the significance of these experimental results was to reinforce what he already believed, that Galileo's relativity principle applied to light waves. This may account for the scant attention he gave to the experiments in his 1905 paper. Einstein had a good feel for experimental findings, and he used this knowledge to find certain fixed points upon which he could construct a theory. But his emphasis was primarily on the deductive approach. Indeed, all three of his epical papers in 1905 begin by asserting his intention to pursue a deductive approach. He opens each one by pointing out some oddity caused by jostling theories, rather than some unexplained set of experimental data. He then postulates grand principles while minimizing the role played by data, be it on Brownian motion or blackbody radiation or the speed of light. In a 1919 essay called Induction and Deduction in Physics, he described his preference for the latter approach. The simplest picture one can form about the creation of an empirical science is along the lines of an inductive method. Individual facts are selected and grouped together so that the laws that connect them become apparent. However, the big advances in scientific knowledge originated in this way only to a small degree. The truly great advances in our understanding of nature originated in a way almost diametrically opposed to induction. The intuitive grasp of the essentials of a large complex of facts leads the scientist to the postulation of a hypothetical basic law or laws. From these laws, he derives his conclusions. His appreciation for this approach would grow. The deeper we penetrate and the more extensive our theories become, he would declare near the end of his life, the less empirical knowledge is needed to determine those theories. The two postulates. Now that Einstein had decided to pursue his theory from the top down by deriving it from grand postulates, he had a choice to make. What postulates, what basic assumptions of general principle, would he start with? His first postulate was the principle of relativity, which asserted that all of the fundamental laws of physics, even Maxwell's equations governing electromagnetic waves, are the same for all observers moving at constant velocity relative to each other. Put more precisely, they are the same for all inertial reference systems, the same for someone at rest relative to the Earth as for someone traveling at a uniform velocity on a train or spaceship. He had nurtured his faith in this postulate, beginning with his thought experiment about riding alongside a light beam. From the very beginning, it appeared to me intuitively clear that, judged from the standpoint of such an observer, everything would have to happen according to the same laws as for an observer who, relative to the Earth, was at rest. For a companion postulate involving the velocity of light, Einstein had at least two options. He could go with an emission theory, in which light would shoot from its source like particles from a gun. There would be no need for an ether. The light particles could zoom through emptiness. Their speed would be relative to the source. If this source was racing toward you, its emissions would come at you faster than if it was racing away. Imagine a pitcher who can throw a ball at 100 miles per hour. If he throws it at you from a car racing toward you, it will come at you faster than if he throws it from a car racing away. In other words, starlight would be emitted from a star at 186,000 miles per second. But if that star was heading toward the Earth at 10,000 miles per second, the speed of its light would be 196,000 miles per second relative to an observer on Earth. An alternative was to postulate that the speed of light was a constant 186,000 miles per second, irrespective of the motion of the source that emitted it, which was more consistent with a wave theory. By analogy with sound waves, a fire truck siren does not throw its sound at you faster when it's rushing toward you than it does when it's standing still. In either case, the sound travels through the air at 770 miles per hour. If the source of sound is rushing toward you, the waves will be compressed and the interval between them will be smaller. The decreased wavelength means a higher frequency, which results in a higher pitched sound, or a lower one when the siren passes by and moves away. A similar effect happens with light. If the source is moving toward you, the wavelength decreases and frequency increases, so it is shifted to the blue end of the spectrum. Light from a source moving away will be red-shifted. For a while, Einstein explored the emission theory route. This approach was particularly appealing if you conceived of light as behaving like a stream of quanta. And as noted in the previous chapter, that concept of light quanta was precisely what Einstein had propounded in March 1905, just when he was wrestling with his relativity theory. But there were problems with this approach. It seemed to entail abandoning Maxwell's equations and the wave theory. If the velocity of a light wave depended on the velocity of the source that emitted it, then the light wave must somehow encode within it this information. But experiments and Maxwell's equations indicated that was not the case. Einstein tried to find ways to modify Maxwell's equations so that they would fit an emission theory, but the quest became frustrating. As he explained to his friend, Paul Ehrenfest, it was hard to figure out what would happen when light from a moving source was refracted or reflected by a screen at rest. Also, in an emission theory, light from an accelerating source might back up on itself. So Einstein rejected the emission theory in favor of postulating that the speed of a light beam was constant no matter how fast its source was moving. I came to the conviction that all light should be defined by frequency and intensity alone, completely independently of whether it comes from a moving or from a stationary light source, he told Ehrenfest. Now Einstein had two postulates, the principle of relativity and this new one, which he called the light postulate. He defined it carefully. Light always propagates in empty space with a definite velocity, v, that is independent of the state of motion of the emitting body. For example, when you measure the velocity of light coming from the headlight of a train, it will always be a constant 186,000 miles per second, even if the train is rushing toward you or backing away from you. Unfortunately, this light postulate seemed to be incompatible with the principle of relativity. Why? Einstein later used the following thought experiment to explain his apparent dilemma. Imagine that a ray of light is sent along the embankment of a railway track, he said. A man standing on the embankment would measure its speed as 186,000 miles per second as it zipped past him. But now imagine a woman who is riding in a very fast train carriage that is racing away from the light source at 2,000 miles per second. We would assume that she would observe the beam to be zipping past her at only 184,000 miles per second. The velocity of propagation of a ray of light relative to the carriage thus comes out smaller, Einstein wrote. But this result comes into conflict with the principle of relativity, he added. For, like every other general law of nature, the law of the transmission of light must, according to the principle of relativity, be the same when the railway carriage is the reference body as it is when the embankment is the reference body. In other words, Maxwell's equations, which determine the speed at which light propagates, should operate the same way in the moving carriage as on the embankment. There should be no experiment you can do, including measuring the speed of light, to distinguish which inertial frame of reference is at rest and which is moving at a constant velocity. This was an odd result. A woman racing along the tracks toward or away from the source of a light beam should see that beam zip by her with the exact same speed as an observer standing on the embankment would see that same beam zip by him. The woman's speed relative to the train would vary, depending on whether she was running toward it or away from it. But her speed relative to the light beam coming from the train's headlight would be invariant. All of this made the two postulates, Einstein thought, seemingly incompatible. As he later explained in a lecture on how he came to his theory, the constancy of the velocity of light is not consistent with the law of the addition of velocities. The result was that I had to spend almost 1 year in fruitless thoughts. By combining the light postulate with the principle of relativity, it meant that an observer would measure the speed of light as the same, whether the source was moving toward or away from him, or whether he was moving toward or away from the source, or both, or neither. The speed of light would be the same, whatever the motion of the observer and the source. That is where matters stood in early May 1905. Einstein had embraced the relativity principle and elevated it to a postulate. Then, with a bit more trepidation, he had adopted as a postulate that the velocity of light was independent of the motion of its source. And he puzzled over the apparent dilemma that an observer racing up a track toward a light would see the beam coming at him with the same velocity as when he was racing away from the light, and with the same velocity as someone standing still on the embankment would observe the same beam. In view of this dilemma, there appears to be nothing else to do than to abandon either the principle of relativity or the simple law of the propagation of light, Einstein wrote. Then something delightful happened. Albert Einstein, while talking with a friend, took one of the most elegant imaginative leaps in the history of physics. The Step. It was a beautiful day in Bern, Einstein later remembered, when he went to visit his best friend, Michele Besso, the brilliant but unfocused engineer he had met while studying in Zurich and then recruited to join him at the Swiss Patent Office. Many days they would walk to work together, and on this occasion Einstein told Besso about the dilemma that was dogging him. "I'm going to give it up," Einstein said at one point. But as they discussed it, Einstein recalled, "I suddenly understood the key to the problem." The next day, when he saw Besso, Einstein was in a state of great excitement. He skipped any greeting and immediately declared, "Thank you, I've completely solved the problem." Only 5 weeks elapsed between that eureka moment and the day that Einstein sent off his most famous paper on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. It contained no citations of other literature, no mention of anyone else's work, and no acknowledgments except for the charming one in the last sentence. "Let me note that my friend and colleague M. Besso steadfastly stood by me in my work on the problem discussed here, and that I am indebted to him for several valuable suggestions." So what was the insight that struck him while talking to Besso? "An analysis of the concept of time was my solution," Einstein said. "Time cannot be absolutely defined, and there is an inseparable relation between time and signal velocity." More specifically, the key insight was that two events that appear to be simultaneous to one observer will not appear to be simultaneous to another observer who is moving rapidly. And there is no way to declare that one of the observers is really correct. In other words, there is no way to declare that the two events are truly simultaneous. Einstein later explained this concept by using a thought experiment involving moving trains. Suppose lightning bolts strike the train track's embankment at two distant places, A and B. If we declare they struck simultaneously, what does that mean? Einstein realized that we need an operational definition, one we can actually apply, and that would require taking into account the speed of light. His answer was that we would define the two strikes as simultaneous if we were standing exactly halfway between them, and the light from each reached us at the exact same time. But now, let us imagine how the event looks to a train passenger who is moving rapidly along the track. In a 1916 book written to explain this to non-scientists, he used a drawing to illustrate the idea. A long train, moving from left to right, travels parallel to an embankment. The midpoint of the embankment is marked M, with point A to its left and point B to its right. Suppose that at the exact instant, from the viewpoint of the person on the embankment, when lightning strikes at points A and B, there is a passenger at the midpoint of the train, M, just passing the observer, who is at the midpoint alongside the tracks. If the train was motionless relative to the embankment, the passenger inside would see the lightning flashes simultaneously, just as the observer on the embankment would. But if the train is moving to the right relative to the embankment, the observer inside will be rushing closer toward place B while the light signals are traveling. Thus, he will be positioned slightly to the right by the time the light arrives. As a result, he will see the light from the strike at place B before he will see the light from the strike at place A. So he will assert that lightning hit at B before it did so at A, and the strikes were not simultaneous. We thus arrive at the important result. Events that are simultaneous with reference to the embankment are not simultaneous with respect to the train, said Einstein. The principle of relativity says that there is no way to decree that the embankment is at rest and the train in motion. We can say only that they are in motion relative to each other. So there is no real or right answer. There is no way to say that any two events are absolutely or really simultaneous. This is a simple insight, but also a radical one. It means that there is no absolute time. Instead, all moving reference frames have their own relative time. Although Einstein refrained from saying that this leap was as truly revolutionary as the one he made about light quanta, it did, in fact, transform science. This was a change in the very foundation of physics, an unexpected and very radical change that required all the courage of a young and revolutionary genius, noted Werner Heisenberg, who later contributed to a similar feat with his principle of quantum uncertainty. In his 1905 paper, Einstein used a vivid image, which we can imagine him conceiving as he watched the trains moving into the Bern station past rows of clocks that were synchronized with the one atop the town's famed tower. "Our judgments in which time plays a part are always judgments of simultaneous events," he wrote. "If, for instance, I say, that train arrives here at 7 o'clock, I mean something like this. The pointing of the small hand of my watch to 7 and the arrival of the train are simultaneous events. Once again, however, observers who are moving rapidly relative to one another will have a different view on whether two distant events are simultaneous. The concept of absolute time, meaning a time that exists in reality and tick-tocks along independent of any observations of it, had been a mainstay of physics ever since Newton had made it a premise of his Principia 216 years earlier. The same was true for absolute space and distance. Absolute, true, and mathematical time of itself and from its own nature flows equably without relation to anything external, he famously wrote in Book 1 of the Principia. Absolute space in its own nature without relation to anything external remains always similar and immovable. But even Newton seemed discomforted by the fact that these concepts could not be directly observed. "Absolute time is not an object of perception," he admitted. He resorted to relying on the presence of God to get him out of the dilemma. "The deity endures forever and is everywhere present, and by existing always and everywhere, he constitutes duration and space." Ernst Mach, whose books had influenced Einstein and his fellow members of the Olympia Academy, lambasted Newton's notion of absolute time as a useless metaphysical concept that cannot be produced in experience. Newton, he charged, acted contrary to his expressed intention only to investigate actual facts. Henri Poincaré also pointed out the weakness of Newton's concept of absolute time in his book Science and Hypothesis, another favorite of the Olympia Academy. "Not only do we have no direct intuition of the equality of two times, we do not even have one of the simultaneity of two events occurring in different places," he wrote. Both Mach and Poincaré were, it thus seems, useful in providing a foundation for Einstein's great breakthrough. But he owed even more, he later said, to the skepticism he learned from the Scottish philosopher David Hume regarding mental constructs that were divorced from purely factual observations. Given the number of times in his papers that he uses thought experiments involving moving trains and distant clocks, it is also logical to surmise that he was helped in visualizing and articulating his thoughts by the trains that moved past Bern's clock tower and the rows of synchronized clocks on the station platform. In addition, Einstein's chief duty at the patent office, in partnership with Besso, was evaluating electromechanical devices. This included a flood of applications for ways to synchronize clocks by using electric signals. We should be careful not to overemphasize the role played by the technological backdrop of the patent office. Yet the influence was there. As Einstein himself stated, "His time in the patent office stimulated me to see the physical ramifications of theoretical concepts." And Alexander Moskovsky, who compiled a book in 1921 based on conversations with Einstein, noted that Einstein believed there was a definite connection between the knowledge acquired at the patent office and the theoretical results. On the electrodynamics of moving bodies. Now let's look at how Einstein articulated all of this in the famous paper that the Annalen der Physik received on June 30, 1905. For all its momentous import, it may be one of the most spunky and enjoyable papers in all of science. Most of its insights are conveyed in words and vivid thought experiments, rather than in complex equations. There is some math involved, but it is mainly what a good high school senior could comprehend. The whole paper is a testament to the power of simple language to convey deep and powerfully disturbing ideas, says the science writer Dennis Overby. The paper starts with the asymmetry, that a magnet and wire loop induce an electric current based only on their relative motion to one another. But since the days of Faraday, there had been two different theoretical explanations for the current produced, depending on whether it was the magnet or the loop that was in motion. Einstein writes, "The observable phenomenon here depends only on the relative motion of the conductor and the magnet, whereas the customary view draws a sharp distinction between the two cases, in which either the one or the other of these bodies is in motion." The distinction between the two cases was based on the belief, which most scientists still held, that there was such a thing as a state of rest with respect to the ether. But the magnet and coil example, along with every observation made on light, suggests that the phenomena of electrodynamics, as well as of mechanics, possess no properties corresponding to the idea of absolute rest. This prompts Einstein to raise, to the status of a postulate, the principle of relativity, which holds that the laws of mechanics and electrodynamics are the same in all reference systems moving at constant velocity relative to one another. Einstein goes on to propound the other postulate upon which his theory was premised, the constancy of the speed of light, independent of the state of motion of the emitting body. Then, with the casual stroke of a pen and the marvelously insouciant word superfluous, the rebellious patent examiner dismissed two generations' worth of a crude scientific dogma. The introduction of a light ether will prove to be superfluous, inasmuch as the view to be developed here will not require a space at absolute rest. Using these two postulates, Einstein explained the great conceptual step he had taken during his talk with Besso. Two events which, viewed from a system of coordinates, are simultaneous can no longer be looked upon as simultaneous events when envisaged from a system which is in motion relative to that system. In other words, there is no such thing as absolute simultaneity. In phrases so simple as to be seductive, Einstein pointed out that time itself can be defined only by referring to simultaneous events, such as the small hand of a watch pointing to 7 as a train arrives. The obvious yet still astonishing conclusion: with no such thing as absolute simultaneity, there is no such thing as real or absolute time. As he later put it, there is no audible tick-tock everywhere in the world that can be considered as time. Moreover, this realization also meant overturning the other assumption that Newton made at the beginning of his Principia. Einstein showed that if time is relative, so too are space and distance. If the man in the carriage covers the distance W in a unit of time, measured from the train, then this distance, as measured from the embankment, is not necessarily also equal to W. Einstein explained this by asking us to picture a rod that has a certain length when it is measured while it is stationary relative to the observer. Now imagine that the rod is moving. How long is the rod? One way to determine this is by moving alongside the rod at the same speed and superimposing a measuring stick on it. But how long would the rod be if measured by someone not in motion with it? In that case, a way to measure the moving rod would be to determine, based on synchronized stationary clocks, the precise location of each end of the rod at a specific moment, and then use a stationary ruler to measure the distance between these two points. Einstein shows that these methods will produce different results. Why? Because the two stationary clocks have been synchronized by a stationary observer. But what happens if an observer who is moving as fast as the rod tries to synchronize those clocks? She would synchronize them differently because she would have a different perception of simultaneity. As Einstein put it, Observers moving with the moving rod would thus find that the two clocks were not synchronous, while observers in the stationary system would declare the clocks to be synchronous. Another consequence of special relativity is that a person standing on the platform will observe that time goes more slowly on a train speeding past. Imagine that on the train there is a clock made up of a mirror on the floor and one on the ceiling, and a beam of light that bounces up and down between them. From the perspective of a woman on the train, the light goes straight up and then straight down. But from the perspective of a man standing on the platform, it appears that the light is starting at the bottom but moving on a diagonal to get to the ceiling mirror, which has zipped ahead a tiny bit, then bouncing down on a diagonal back to the mirror on the floor, which has in turn zipped ahead a tiny bit. For both observers, the speed of light is the same. That is Einstein's great given. The man on the track observes the distance the light has to travel as being longer than the woman on the train observes it to be. Thus, from the perspective of the man on the track, time is going by more slowly inside the speeding train. This phenomenon, called time dilation, leads to what is known as the twin paradox. If a man stays on the platform while his twin sister takes off in a spaceship that travels long distances near the speed of light, when she returns, she would be younger than he is. But because motion is relative, this seems to present a paradox. The sister on the spaceship might think it's her brother on Earth who is doing the fast traveling, and when they are rejoined, she would expect to observe that it was he who did not age much. Could they each come back younger than the other one? Of course not. The phenomenon does not work in both directions. Because the spaceship does not travel at a constant velocity, but instead must turn around, it's the twin on the spaceship, not the one on Earth, who would age more slowly. The phenomenon of time dilation has been experimentally confirmed, even by using test clocks on commercial planes. But in our normal life, it has no real impact, because our motion relative to any other observer is never anything near the speed of light. In fact, if you spent almost your entire life on an airplane, you would have aged merely 50 microseconds or so less than your twin on Earth when you returned, an effect that would likely be counteracted by a lifetime spent eating airline food. Special relativity has many other curious manifestations. Think again about that light clock on the train. What happens as the train approaches the speed of light relative to an observer on the platform? It would take almost forever for a light beam in the train to bounce from the floor to the moving ceiling and back to the moving floor. Thus, time on the train would almost stand still from the perspective of an observer on the platform. As an object approaches the speed of light, its apparent mass also increases. Newton's law that force equals mass times acceleration still holds. But as the apparent mass increases, more and more force will produce less and less acceleration. There is no way to apply enough force to push even a pebble faster than the speed of light. That's the ultimate speed limit of the universe, and no particle or piece of information can go faster than that, according to Einstein's theory. With all this talk of distance and duration being relative depending on the observer's motion, some may be tempted to ask, so which observer is right? Whose watch shows the actual time elapsed? Which length of the rod is real? Whose notion of simultaneity is correct? According to the special theory of relativity, all inertial reference frames are equally valid. It is not a question of whether rods actually shrink or time really slows down. All we know is that observers in different states of motion will measure things differently. And now that we have dispensed with the ether as superfluous, there is no designated rest frame of reference that has preference over any other.